Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin.
I had the great fortune of sitting down with guitar legend icon Al DiMeola, who was always a big influence on me growing up. And one of the first things we spoke about was Larry Coryell as his teacher and all of his early influences for fusion.
Yeah, when I was 15, I remember going out to his farm. He had rented a farmhouse in New Hope, Pennsylvania. And I think I had a lesson or two with him, and then I just followed him, you know, in the village whenever he played. I went to so many of his shows, and yeah, Larry was a character, but he was bridging all the gaps, you know. He, you know, connected all the different worlds of music, you know, and that was very attractive to me at the time, you know. I started taking lessons when I was about 9 or 10, right around that age, and with a guy who was more versed in old school jazz, like Johnny Smith and Tal Farlow. That kind of not that I picked him, it's just he was a kind of appointed to me, and so I got kind of the best of both worlds, you know, because I certainly was not into that music that young, but you know, I got a lot of training in that area. You know, all the theory and all the reading and all the, you know, standards and all that stuff. Well, I loved all the rock stuff that was happening. You know, I spent my teen years going into the city to the Fillmore East and checking out all the bands from the Allman Brothers to Santana, and, you know, playing all the British bands, Jethro Tull, you know. So, yeah, I was into all of that stuff, you know, Blind Faith, Traffic. You know, it was really Larry, you know, I think Larry and Miles Davis and Bitches Brew. And, you know, it was kind of the entry point was finding people that were, you know, merging, you know, rock with jazz, rock elements of, you know, classical as well. And it was just more interesting to me because, you know, coming from childhood when I was so immersed in the rock and the, you know, rock music from whether it be the LA scene, San Francisco or London, pretty much New York didn't have anything, which was really surprising. It was really LA, San Francisco and London. And then, you know, the Beatles at the end, you know, when they ended their term together and they went solo, that's when I lost a lot of interest in what they were doing solo. And it kind of pushed me towards, you know, looking for something else. Yeah, well, you know, just, you know, being influenced by the seminal days of fusion, I just immersed myself in you know, that kind of music. And I just, you know, bought so many of those records and I started to emulate those styles. Yeah, and then I got a gig with Barry Miles, who was a jazz pianist, but was also, you know, paving the path for with this whole new fusion sound. He was really the first fusion artist in the world, was Barry Miles. He's like an unsung hero, you know, just very, very behind the scenes guy that never really went for it, you know, but he was really the first guy to do that thing. And then, you know, after a short semester and a half at Berkeley, I got a gig playing with him for about 9 months. That kind of schooling I had playing with Barry, you know, reading all those long charts and everything, really set me up for what was to come with RTF. So I already had a taste of, you know, playing in, you know, kind of like the minor leagues, you know.
That's a great way of putting it. It was the minor leagues, but Barry Miles is really, truly an unsung hero, a great pianist, and really was one of the forefathers of fusion. I went on to ask Al DiMeola about his acoustic work and how he got so involved with it coming from fusion.
When I joined RTF, Chick always liked to have a short little, you know, solo acoustic set for each guy within the electric set, which was a good idea. Just there was kind of like you know, I was pushed into doing it. So it's something I had to do. So I immediately had to come up with something. Yeah, it was like throwing a baby in the deep end of the water, of the pool. You know, that's, I had to swim. That's what happened there. So that developed fast because it, you know, everything back then was like quick. You know, the influences, the growth of my ability happened fast. You know, because it had to. Well, you weren't going to make it. But the acoustic, well, no, it didn't happen until, you know, my second solo album. I had one acoustic track I wrote, and I invited Paco de Lucia. And then that became like a giant hit single all over the world. Even though it wasn't the typical hit single you'd expect, but it became a hit single anyway. And then the success of that, you know, we had a lot of talks about, you know, maybe someday going out and doing it live. So we were approached by an impresario out of London who was now McCartney's, you know, main guy, his main agent, Barry Marshall, but he started with us in the business. Yeah. So Barry is the biggest, he's the biggest there is in martial arts. And, he put together me, John, and Paco for a two-month tour in 1980, which resulted in, at the end of the tour, us recording at Friday Night in San Francisco, which sold 7 million records. So, you know.
That's an incredible feat for an acoustic record like that to sell 7 million records. And it's an incredible album. If you actually have never heard it, please go listen to it. Now we spoke about his electric tour that's currently going on and how his compositions and his playing has evolved.
I saw then my life later on, you know, where I might give up electric guitar for a lot of obvious reasons. You know, I just can't see myself at 85 playing super loud music. Yeah, I can't even see it now, but I'm doing it. A little bit reluctantly because it's so loud and it's just, it's not where I've grown to, you know what I mean? I definitely after 34 records, I've, you know, the compositions have evolved and my writing has really evolved. So going back to the early music is a lot of fun, I gotta say, but it's certainly not as deep and aesthetic as the newer stuff, you know? I mean, I rediscovered kind of like not listened to it for so long, but I pulled out some of those charts and they were more interesting than I thought, you know, and to play that same guitar, the same Black Les Paul, which I haven't played since 1978, I have it out on tour with me. So it's, I'm recreating the music in more ways than one, you know. So what I'm doing is I'm also featuring a couple from the first Return to Forever album. So when I joined the band, in fact, I tell the story of how I went into the first rehearsal and the first piece that was put in front of me was Beyond the Seventh Galaxy, Pharaoh Kings. And I have those charts with me and we're playing them live. So it's going all the way back to when I was 19. Yeah, and it deserves to be played again because it's so, they're so great, you know, and to only, you know, write new music and kind of forget about the past is not happening. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, there's no pop act that does that. You know, if they have a hit, they play their hits, you know. These are my hits, you know. Well, I have a veteran keyboard player that I sponsored coming into the country. His name is Philippe Sace. He came from Paris, France, back in 1978. And he was in my first band. It's a reunion, definitely, for sure, because I got Gumby as well, Gumby Ortiz on percussion. So he's played with me many, many times in the past, in so many different groups and records. I have also two musicians that Gumby brought in, one from Venezuela on bass, Elias Tona is his name, and on drums, Luis Alicea on drums. That rounds out the group. So yeah, so the set list are all songs that, you know, the diehard listeners from the early years would all, you know, with all love, because it's the ones they like the most.
And he did not disappoint. He played such classic songs from Elegant Gypsy and Land of the Midnight Sun. I went on to ask him about Tina Guo, because I had worked with her in the studio as well. She's a wonderful cello player, and they did a Metallica song together. He also goes on to explain the Beatles tribute he did.
Tina Guo? Yeah, she's great, yeah. Yeah, we did that in Germany when she was part of my group. Yeah, she was part of my group for a whole tour in Germany. Not just Germany, I think it was also Europe. I don't think she knew too much about my music before she took the gig, but you know, I think friends of her was like, oh, you got to play with Aldi Meola. One thing about Tina, she was really a great a member of the band. She took great direction. You know, she was very, very, you know, like a classical musician, very, very well-disciplined and, you know, can read really well, and play perfectly, you know. And I said, the one thing you have to do, Tina, is learn how to improvise. If she improvised, she would still be in my band. I mean, for sure. It's the classical side, yeah. And you can get away with that with heavy metal. So she loved heavy metal and she loved classical, but she didn't have any jazz chops at all. You know, being the other instrument in the band other than the piano, you know, I really needed her to improvise, you know, but there was no possibility. She had no clue how to do that. But everything else was stellar, you know, and her attitude was phenomenal, you know. So she was great in her own classical way, you know. I said, who's the band? She said, Metallica. I said, well, I never heard of it. We'll do it anyway. The Beatles are in our life every day, you know, no matter what. We see or hear something about the Beatles on a daily basis, even now. Yeah, it's embedded, and then we get reminded every day, you know, there's something about Paul or something about somebody of the Beatles, and well, we see something, you know. It's just constant reminders of the greatness of that music, the aesthetic. It's actually aesthetic pop music, you know. Now, I really wanted to respect the song as close to the original as possible, you know, and but not do it the same way the Beatles did it, you know. So it was a fine line, but it was a smart thing to do, because those melodies are incredible, and also the chord changes were great. And I picked songs that had really nice changes, you know. I sat down with the music, and I went through the songs that had the most interesting harmonic, you know, changes that I can do things with, you know. Like, I couldn't do anything with Come Together because there's only one chord, you know. So I picked songs that had beautiful changes, like And I Love Her, Michelle, Penny Lane, you know, Strawberry Fields, I Am the Walrus. There's so much meat in those compositions. You know, that it became a project of passion for me. And the first one was done at Abbey Road, so I was like a kid in Disney World. I felt like a 5-year-old going to Disney World for the first time. I mean, a feeling we don't get as adults, I got that by experiencing that and you know, being there every day. It was just something that, you know, we don't get anymore, that kind of thrill.
I can only imagine what kind of thrill that was for him, being a Beatles fan and recording at Abbey Road Studios, the very studio that they had done all of their wonderful classic albums. Now he goes on to tell me about his brand new album and how he survived a heart attack on stage.
I've been working for 3 years on what is going to be like my final opus. I say that because I almost died in September, you know, with a heart attack. It was in Romania, right in the middle of a song. I was rushed to the hospital and I had surgery and everything. Yeah. Yeah, I had the best guy working on me, so it was cool. They put stents in, you know, the stents, you know, it's kind of like a minor surgery, you know, back to normal. Even better than before. If you put an Aldi Meola heart attack, there's a picture that comes up. And you see me leaning over the guitar. That was the moment in which I had it. No, I didn't pass out. I remember it. I was awake the whole time. But it was a feeling like 5,000-pound weight was in the middle of my chest. So it was, the pain was unreal. But anyway, this record is going to surprise people. It's a double record, double studio album. And it's a ton of great stuff on it. Really proud of this record. It started out as a solo acoustic record, and then because of COVID, having so much time home, I just got carried away, and it became more than half the record. I would say a record and a half's worth are with full production. So you know, I'm playing all the percussion, bass, keyboards. I'm playing electric guitar on at least a third of the record. So. Yeah, but it's primarily, you know, the first and foremost acoustic. I had a guest tabla player who's amazing, probably the top tabla player in the world today. His name is Amit Kavlekar from India. And I had, Tommy Breckline on drums on a piece. I had Gumby Ortiz on a piece. Mostly it's myself doing everything. Oh, and I had a singer from Spain, Ivan Lopez, on a piece that's going to surprise people. And I also have the chamber orchestra on three pieces as well. It'll come out July 18th. Yeah, I was hoping for March, but then they just want to set it up. You know, there's a lot of pre-promotion that goes into it, and they don't want to just throw it out there. You know, so. I was actually shocked they're going to put it out in July because they have it now.
It was a wonderful honor to interview Al DiMeola and meeting him after the show. And everybody, please be sure to go support Al when that album comes out in July. Now I'm going to hit it off with Race with the Devil on the Spanish Highway live from Tour de Force. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Al DiMeola, and you're listening to Guitar Tracks on WFIT, the best instrumental music on the Space Coast.
That's one of my favorite songs by Al DiMeola, Cruising, from Electric Rendezvous, featuring Jan Hammer on keyboards. Before that was Tina Guo, featuring Al, on the Metallica remake Sanitarium.